Good evening, everyone. Well, what a wonderful turnout for our guest this evening, and I have the great pleasure of introducing Dr. David Myers. Dr. David Myers is both a psychologist and a man of faith. David Myers grew up in Seattle and earned his bachelor's degree from Whitworth College, where, of course, he majored in chemistry. He then attended the University of Iowa, where he earned his master's and doctorate degrees in psychology. He has been a faculty member at Hope College since 1967 and has been the John Dirk Workman Professor of Psychology since 1983. Dave is a social psychologist by training and has published many articles on group behavior and decision making in journals such as the Journal of Personality, the Journal of Social Psychology, and the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. He is also a gifted writer and has published over a dozen books, including textbooks for introductory psychology and social psychology, which we use in our classes, along with 1,000 other schools worldwide, as well as trade books on topics ranging from the pursuit of happiness to living with hearing loss to gay marriage. Tonight he will be speaking to us on why God is good and faith isn't evil, based on his most recent book of the same title. Dave has a unique talent for digesting and disseminating psychological research for the lay audience, and does so with great insight and wit. Robert Sternberg, past president of the American Psychological Association, has referred to Dave as the best writer in psychology. You would never know that he received his lowest grade at Whitworth in English composition. David Myers is also a man of faith, and while he is certainly skilled in the written word, his religious devotion is translated into action. Not only is he an elder and teacher at his home church, but he also donates all his royalties from his introductory texts and his trade books to charity via the David and Carol Myers Foundation. The psychology department and the greater Whitworth community have benefited from Dave's generosity. Dave has been a great contributor to the dialogue between psychology and religion, offering each discipline's perspective of the other. He's also a very humble man, and I'm sure that everything I've said so far has embarrassed him, but I'm not quite done yet. Dave is an all-weather bicyclist, which in Michigan, as in Spokane, really means something, and an avid noontime basketball player. He's also a world traveler, and this year alone he has been to Beijing, Istanbul, Zurich, and Florida Atlantic University. There was four places that he mentioned, so lots of exotic locations. Dr. Myers is also a great mentor. I have known Dave for, I believe, 13 years now, and he has mentored me from my time at Hope College to writing me letters of recommendation, including the one for this job, and to helping me get a couple of really cool speaking engagements. In other words, Dave is what we might call a quality person, the kind of person that one feels extremely privileged to know. So, without further ado, Dr. David Myers.
Thank you. Patty Brunix is part of our gift from our place called Hope to this place called Whitworth, which I walked onto the campus of 49 years ago this fall. And let me tell you, I came from a high school working in the family business, not interested in books or the life of the mind, not with a lot of self-confidence. I was way too scared ever to have dated. Somehow, 4 years later, I walked out of here married to a fellow Whitworthian who's been my life partner for 48 years, destined for the academic life on my way to graduate school. So something transformative happened here. And I'm back here tonight and serving on the trustees and will be on the presidential search committee, partly as a payback of my gesture of debt for what happened to me. What happened to me is that where I ended up was nowhere near what I had in mind when I walked onto campus here. And for those of you who are first-year students, that would be my prediction for your life as well. Where you're going to end up is not where you presently have in mind ending up. And indeed, that is why you're best served by a liberal education that prepares you for that unpredictable future, to think, to write, to analyze, to communicate, in whatever career occupation you might ultimately find yourself. So, where I find myself and where I found myself over the last several decades of my career is going places I never imagined. And most recently, I was drawn into a place that I'll tell you about tonight by engaging what's called the New Atheist Literature. And I have in mind such things as the best-selling books by Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, Sam Harris, such as Letter to a Christian Nation, Christopher Hitchens, God is Not Great, all of which together have fed this growing hostility towards religion in the wider culture. And thus, for example, recent national surveys by the National Opinion Research Center has found that while there's a great positive opinion and a great deal of confidence in the scientific community, we see over time diminishing respect for organized religion. And indeed, this new anti-religious fervor is manifest in magazine articles, in movies such as Bill Maher's movie Religious, which is a combination of religion and ridiculous. Where is all this hostility toward religion coming from? It seems to me it's coming partly from religion's perceived antagonism to science, as reflected in its opposition to stem cell research. It's questioning what are coming to be understood as the realities of sexual orientation. It's particularly on the part of conservative Christians, the denial of evidence of global climate change and the need to deal with it, and opposition to the teaching of evolution. Secondly, it's coming from religion's perceived contribution to violence post 9/11, on which those terrorists drove those planes through a wormhole which they were believing would take them to a blissful afterlife. And thereafter, when President Bush took us into the war in Iraq, he declared that God would tell me, George, go and end the tyranny in Iraq. Religion, in some sense, in the president's own words, drove him into that conflict. And even today, we have survey data showing us that churchgoers are more likely to back torture as a means of trying to exact confessions. Robert Putnam, the Harvard public policy researcher, author of the famed book Bowling Alone, has a new book coming out in which he's going to argue that the so-called politicization of religion triggered great hostility toward religion, leading to a dramatic growth in secularism. Thus, it seems as if the extreme elements of the religious right have actually had a toxic effect, in my world at least, on the credibility of the faith. Reminded me of Madeleine L'Engle saying that Christians have given Christianity a bad name. There's another factor at work, and that is the growing research on the science of religion that attempts to explain the religious impulse in terms of evolutionary psychology, neuroscientific mechanisms that underlie religious belief and feeling, cognitive explanations of religion, and social-cultural explanations of religion, all of which together, in the minds of many of those doing the research, help explain religion away. The idea is that if you can explain why people are religious in any one of these terms, or collectively in all these terms, then you've debunked religion as a credible belief system. But the first point I want to suggest to you tonight is that that is plainly not so. The reasons why somebody believes X or Y has nothing at all to do with the truth of that belief. Thus, for example, though we have articles like in the New Scientist magazine, how your brain creates, manufactures this illusion of God, well, we can play this game the other way too. Could we not potentially have a scientific study of what leads people to atheism? And in fact, there has been in history books written on topics like the psychology of unbelief. What leads people to be doubters, skeptics, non-believers? There's a new website out of Cambridge University that's investigatingatheism.info that is the study of atheism and what would drive people to it. By the way, I've tried my own hand at this, just trying to explore what I call the maleness and the paleness of skepticism and atheism. Just a few little facts I've come up with in my meanderings. For example, in the Skeptical Inquirer magazine's list of 24 20th century heroes, what did they all share in common? They were all white men. if we look at who authors books for Prometheus Books, which is the leading publisher of books of skepticism and atheism in North America, one thing they share in common is almost all their authors are men. There are very few women among their authors. The Skeptic Society did a survey of its members. 4 out of 5 were guys. And if we look at who's irreligious, that is, who's not worshiping regularly, who's not praying faithfully, we find that it's mostly men. And by the way, it's mostly white men, as it turns out. And in fact, you can do some website demographics that are also kind of revealing. And just to illustrate, one website that estimates the demographics of any given well-visited website shows us, first of all, if you go to ask people visiting Google, who are they? Well, they're 50% male and 50% female, estimated from the available data gathered by Quantcast. Oh, I thought I changed this on my slide. I had Whitworth.edu. Whitworth, I did check this afternoon, is like 61-54. Hope is 54-46. My website is 50-50. Now let's go to goodhousekeeping.com. That's 70% female. Sports Illustrated, that's 70% male. If we go to beliefnet.com, that's a spirituality site, we find that's 2-to-1 female. If we go to richarddawkins.net, that's 2-to-1 male. Or to skeptic.com, that's 2-to-1 male. Okay, we found a very interesting thing. Part of our little social-cultural explanation of skepticism and atheism is that it's predominantly a white guy thing. That doesn't begin to debunk it. That is not evidence against it. It's just a fact, and we could continue with this exploration. But at the end of the day, knowing why somebody believes and somebody else doubts gives us no basis whatsoever for demeaning either of those belief systems. Well, some other thoughts. Is it true that, in fact, religion is hostile to science? First of all, in history, that is decidedly not true. First of all, we have the basic theistic idea that underlies skepticism, which is one of humility. And it grows out of two assumptions. Number one, that there is a God. And number two, that it's not me and it's not you. And once we accept those two realities, then everything's up for grabs. The surest belief I can hold is the conviction that some of my beliefs err. And insofar as that is true, then I have something to learn from scientific inquiry, from being challenged by other people, including perhaps from you all this evening. Therefore, we should hold our own untested beliefs tentatively. We should assess others' ideas with open-minded skepticism. And when appropriate, we should use observation and experimentation to winnow error from truth. This idea is actually represented in Scripture in several places. Moses, for example, declared that if a prophet speaks the name of the Lord and what he said does not come true, then it's not the Lord's message. That, folks, is straightforward empiricism. St. Paul said, test everything. Hold fast to what is good. That is certainly, in some sense, the spirit of science. The tradition that I come from, Presbyterian, Reformed, holds in some quarters as its motto, including that of the seminary across the street from me, that we are called to be reformed and ever reforming. There's a kind of openness which is embodied and embraced in the vision of this institution of being faith committed and open, inquiring, and engaging change all at the same time. And thus, it's those ideas that were part of the religious roots of contemporary science, whose founders, such as what you see here on the screen, were deep people of faith who wondered and wanted to explore how God did it. And even today, our calling as people in the natural and social sciences is to love God with our minds, with unbridled free pursuit of truth, the attempt to discern it and communicate it. That is my calling and my mission. And thus we aim to search the book of God's word and the book of God's works, with no ultimate allegiance to what anybody should think about either one of those things. And so, for all these reasons, faith doesn't just permit, it doesn't just allow science, it mandates science. And thus, it's very appropriate that Whitworth University should be contemplating an enormous investment of university resources in the expansion, the creation of new science facilities for educating sciences. And I'm very proud at a deeply religious institution to come from a place that has had more National Science Foundation undergraduate research grants than any other undergraduate institution in the United States, which most recent summer, for which I had the data, had 177 students working full-time in scientific research on campus during the summer. Don't tell me that faith is hostile to science. In the world in which I live, faith embraces, it mandates science. And science also, I must say, along the way, as part of this openness, has led me to change my mind about some things. This is not the main point of tonight's talk, but I want just to acknowledge that contrary to what I long ago believed, the evidence now persuasively indicates to me and certainly to my colleagues in fields like geology and biology that the Earth is ancient, that all creatures evolved, and also that the universe had a very precise beginning, if you will, it had a moment of creation, and is incredibly, improbably, mind-blowingly fine-tuned for the emergence of life in a way that suggests, or at least is consistent with, the idea of something strange and wonderful happening. Second, sexual orientation turns out to be a natural, enduring disposition, not a moral choice. And that's something has been the subject of another book, which could be the subject for another bedtime story, but it's not tonight's bedtime story, how one takes these data and the emerging understanding of the pertinent biblical text and the relevant evidence for the significance of close relationships and marriage and weaves those things into a Christian case for gay marriage. What I want to do, though, is take you to a different place and now to focus in on the point of tonight's talk. I want to engage the new atheist contention that religion, all religions, are toxic. As Richard Dawkins said, faith is one of the world's great evils. Christopher Hitchens wrote, religion is violent, irrational, intolerant, allied to racism and tribalism and bigotry, invested in ignorance and hostile to free inquiry, contemptuous of women and coercive toward children. Sam Harris put it more simply, speaking for them all, religion is both false and dangerous. Now, it's the dangerous part that I want to focus on. Is that true? And reading that and reading their evidence is what compelled me to offer maybe a little different picture than what their data suggests. Is religion toxic? Or does it contribute to human flourishing? Well, what we have in the existing literature is a battle of anecdotes. On the one side, the new atheists remind us of the horrors of the Crusades and the Inquisitions, the Bible-banging KKKers, the gay-bashing religious right today. In response to them, religion's defenders remind us of the faith-rooted anti-slavery movement, the faith-fostered beginnings of hospitals, orphanages, universities, all of which grew out of the life of the church. Well, okay, say the new atheists, but what about the horrors done by today's Muslim terrorists and the Taliban? But, respond religion's defenders, think about the genocides that were undertaken by atheist dictators such as Stalin and Mao, who did not value human life as the children of God. Well, we can continue this, if you will, battle of historical anecdotes. And it's more than mere anecdotes, since these are all significant historical events. And the extremes remind us that religion comes in varied forms with varied effects. What I'm going to show you data on now are the effects of religion in general. I realize this glosses over enormous differences among religion, which ranges from the Taliban to Mennonite peace workers. And there's huge differences within that. And yet, to compare the religious with the irreligious still makes some sense, in much the same sense that we might compare men and women, despite the fact that we acknowledge that there's enormous variation within each gender. Or we might compare the mental processing speed of older and younger adults. Somebody might say, well, that makes no sense, because individuals differ much more than do people across the age span. That's true, but it's still meaningful to ask, what is the association of age with, I use the example of mental processing speed. So mindful that there's enormous religious variation, let's look across time and see the associations between religious engagement and four things. First, very briefly, prejudice. Then, at somewhat greater length, happiness, health, and altruistic generosity of time and resources. First, prejudice. We had a whole bunch of religion prejudice studies a half century ago, which found, first of all, that religious conservative people in the United States express more racial prejudice than did people who were not religiously conservative, Orthodox believers. Secondly, we also, however, found that amongst people who declared themselves as affiliated with some religion, which in the United States where these studies were done, went predominantly Christian, those who were very faithful in their religious engagement, who were weekly attenders as opposed to only occasionally once or twice a month attenders, expressed less prejudice than the occasional nominal attenders. And we also found that people who were what was called intrinsically religious, that is, who declared that their religion motivated their whole approach to life rather than being a good thing for business, for example, expressed less prejudice than did those who were more extrinsically religious. And we also had studies showing us that clergy expressed less prejudice than their average lay members. And indeed, clergy were part of the leadership of the civil rights movement in the United States. So it's a mixed picture here, not a simple picture of the association of religion and prejudice. Happiness, we get a clearer picture. We have mountains of data relating religious engagement to happiness. First, though, we have some contrasting hypotheses. Sigmund Freud saw religion as a sickness that leads people to live sexually repressed, uptight, and therefore unhealthy and unhappy lives. Christopher Hitchens has echoed that. Religion does not make its adherents happy. Richard Dawkins was part of an atheist campaign in Britain recently that had signs on the side of some 600 buses carrying the message, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. You'll enjoy your life more if you give up this God idea. On the other side, we have people like C.S. Lewis, who spoke of joy being the serious business of heaven. It's the mark of the life of faith. So who's right? What is the association of religion with psychological well-being? Well, we have a variety of studies, some of which have looked at well-being among older adults, which have fairly consistently found a tendency for people in later life to experience more social support and greater well-being if they're religiously engaged. Secondly, we have studies of how people cope with a crisis, such as the death of a child, unemployment, the loss of a job, and in each of these areas, religion and religious engagement is found to have what sociologists have called a buffering effect of coping with that sense of loss. Third, there are various studies that associate people's mental health with their religious engagement. Here, it's a weak correlation, but there's some tendency for actively religious people to be less vulnerable to depression, although it certainly strikes all people from all walks of life. By the way, here's data from a recent Gallup study of suicide and religiosity across 67 countries. As you can see on the X, the horizontal axis, we have religiosity. So those are the highly religious countries over at the right, and we have a measure of suicide rate in each of those countries on the vertical axis. And there's a negative correlation, as you can see, between the religiosity of a country and the risk of suicide of people in its within its borders. And finally, we have these massive reports of people's own self-reported happiness. For example, George Gallup Jr., who's a devout Episcopal layperson who has done a lot of studies using the Gallup poll resources of religion in America, created a spiritual commitment index, which is a 7-item index on which people indicated whether they believe in God, pray daily, worship regularly, and so forth. People who score at the low end of this 7-item spiritual commitment index are half as likely to say they're very happy as are those who score at the high end of the spiritual commitment index. If we ask how close they feel to God, we find from national opinion research surveys that those who say they feel extremely close to God are noticeably more likely than those who say they don't feel close to God or don't believe. And when we look across some 48,000 randomly sampled Americans surveyed over the last 30 years by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago, we see that the percentage of very happy people ranges from 26% among those never religiously engaged to 48% among those religiously engaged more than weekly. So no matter what else you can say, there's clearly a very strong correlation between religious engagement and self-reported happiness. We also have some other interesting new data coming in. Barbara Fredrickson, who's a leading positive psychologist, as this new group of psychologists is called, with one of her graduate students, did a study in the day of a day in the life of a flourishing person in North Carolina. And what they wanted to do, what they did, is compare depressed people and flourishing people. Depressed people are the blues. Flourishing people are the greens. The others are there in between. This is the amount of time they spent in the previous day interacting with people. And as you can see, people who live vital, flourishing lives are more socially in contact with other people. They're more likely to have spent time helping somebody else in the previous day. They're much more likely to have been engaged in aerobic exercise, which indeed we know to be a powerful antidote to mild depression and anxiety. And they're dramatically more likely to have spent time in prayer or meditating. We also have recent evidence from what's called the German panel study that actually suggests that religious engagement may not only be associated with well-being, but may have a causal role in affecting happiness. What they ask is whether religious people are happier because, say, they come from religious homes, which offer more stability and emotional security, or whether religious engagement actually lifts happiness. And what they did is they mined data from 20 years of repeated interviews with more than 12,000 Germans who were quizzed periodically over time. And what they found is that individuals who become more religious over time record long-term gains in life satisfaction, while those who become less religious over time thereafter experience diminished satisfaction with life. Thus, they conclude religious beliefs and activities can make a substantial difference in life satisfaction, and they headline their own study as increased religious activity seems to make you happier. And we even have neuroscience evidence of religious conviction being associated with reduced reactivity in a brain area that's involved in the experience of anxiety, which suggests a brain basis by which religious conviction buffers or helps moderate pathological anxiety. In response to these data, which, by the way, are replicated across various European as well as North American countries, people have wondered, what explains this correlation between religious engagement and what we call subjective well-being? Several explanations have been proposed. Maybe you in your own mind already have an idea or two. One is what we call social support. We are, as Aristotle recognized long ago, social animals. We are made to belong. We have a deep need to connect in close, supportive, enduring, intimate relationships. In the United States and Canada, there are some 350,000 faith communities, each of which is, for its active participants, a social support network. People who are there for one another when bad things happen in their lives. And so that seems to be one of the reasons why we're not just talking about spirituality here as practiced in a New Age sense by yourself out in the woods. We're talking about spirituality experienced in community, which is what religion is. In fact, the very word root of religion, religio, means to bind together. It's spirituality experienced in community. It's fellowship, if you will. Secondly, religion is also conducive to impulse control, or what we call self-regulation. And there's a new theory of this that was published in a leading journal of psychological reviews earlier this year that began by noting that the evidence overwhelmingly indicates that religious engagement is associated with, as you can see here, decreased rates of crime, teen pregnancy, as I'm going to show you later, drug abuse, and increased rates of good things like exercise, marital satisfaction, school success. Well, guess what, said the author, Mike McCullough, self-control or self-regulation, impulse control, is also associated with all those good things. And his theory is that religion is conducive to self-control, which is conducive to those things. And in fact, he has a kind of archaeological, anthropological basis for this theory, which notes that the emergence of modern agriculture and the need for the delay of gratification to plant those seeds rather than eat them happened in the Near East in a context where both religion and agriculture emerged at about the same time, because religion was conducive to the delay of gratification and the ability to control self. Another explanation that's been offered is one that has to do with the sense of life's coherence, meaning, and purpose. There are scales that actually measure purpose in life, and people that live with a strong sense of meaning and significance to life live with greater well-being and joy than do those who have trouble defining such. For many such people, their religious faith helps shape their vision, their understanding of life's meaning and purpose. There's also this idea that, we know that self-esteem, by the way, is associated with positive well-being. And might it therefore be the case that if you believe that you are accepted just as you are by what you take to be ultimate, might that be a more durable basis for your own self-acceptance than the vacillating opinions of other people around you? There's also research that shows that people who focus on themselves, as depressed people tend to do with their self-preoccupation, live more miserably than those who don't worry about their own happiness, who are focused beyond themselves on something greater than self. And is there any evidence? I think I'm going to show you some evidence in just a moment, that religiosity, religious engagement, motivates people to look beyond self to a greater, more transcendent sense of purpose. And finally, we have research these days on what's called terror management. What happens when you remind people of the inevitability of their own death and mortality? It has some really interesting consequences, and it suggests, in part, a psychology of religion, because at least Christian faith in particular offers the idea that in the end, the very end, no matter what terrible thing shall happen to you, even death itself, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. If you believe that, does it help you cope with really bad things that are going to happen in the interim? And just as my life has been filled with some very good surprises, it has been filled with some very bad surprises as well, and yours will be too. Well, these are some of the ideas that have been offered to account for this association between religious engagement and positive well-being. By the way, you might ask, if we could control for all these things, social support, self-control, meaning and purpose, and so forth, would there be anything left to the religious factor? Probably not, if we thought of everything. In much the same sense, you might ask a hurricane researcher, well, if you control for the effect of the torrential rains and the wind and the storm surge, would there really be an effect of a hurricane? Well, no. I mean, it would have sucked the life out of the hurricane factor, because a hurricane is a package variable. Its force is defined by the composite of those things. And the religion factor, to a social scientist, is a package variable that incorporates all these things. That's what it is. Let's look now at other interesting research that at first I was skeptical about, that associates religious engagement with human health. I got to know, through being an advisor and later a trustee of the Templeton Foundation, which was funding much of this research, some of the leading researchers in the field of spirituality and health. And as an author of an introductory psychology text that had a chapter on health, I realized I could be reporting on this stuff, but I got to be darn sure of what I'm reporting on, because I got thousands of people using this book, and most of them aren't religious believers. And so, guys, give me your best evidence. What is it? And eventually I was persuaded that there was fire under the smoke. And here's some of the evidence that persuaded me. First, we start with the awareness that there is a connection between certain psychological variables and human health and longevity. We know, for example, that negative emotions are associated with, such as anger and depression, are associated with cardiovascular disease, impaired immune functioning, and even premature death. Well, if religion contributes to positive emotions, might it have a positive effect on health? We also know that social support is very strongly associated with risk of ill health and premature death. So we at least had a reason why it might be so, and indeed it turned out to be so. Here, for example, are data from 21,000 American lives tracked through time by the National Health Interview Survey, which projected life expectancy at age 20 as a function of worship attendance. And as you can see, there is a 7-year life expectancy gap between those attending church more than weekly and those never attending a religious service. That is approximately the life expectancy gap between people who don't smoke and who smoke 2 packs a day. Another epidemiological study following thousands of lives through years of time looked at 5,000 Californians over 28 years. This is the relative risk of dying if one is male blue or female pink bar, does not smoke. You can see you've got about a 40% reduced risk of dying relative to others, exercises regularly, or engages in regular religious attendance, which, as you can see, has about the same health protective effect of regular exercise and not smoking. Well, and now we have brand new data that have just been published from a National Institute of Health study that followed 92,000 women over 8 years. This study controlled for many other factors. Even after trying to control for everything else they could think of, they still found that those attending religious services weekly or more experienced a 20% risk of death over the 8-year study period. As we ask about what accounts for this, we can speculate, I think more than speculate, we have evidence that religious engagement is associated first with healthier living. I said it's about the same gap effect as smoking versus non-smoking. But indeed, part of the effect is smoking versus non-smoking, because actively religious people are much less likely to smoke regularly than people who are not religious, as I'm going to show you a little later here. Also, there's that social support factor. And there's the effect of positive emotions on the immune system and cardiovascular functioning, all of which together help account for religion's positive associations with health, which is a reality that's coming to be widely appreciated by skeptics and others alike. Finally, altruism. First, we have some interesting studies relating faith to human values that show us that actively religious people, in times past at least, have been much less likely to be juvenile delinquents, to abuse drugs and alcohol. And in studies on the other side of the Atlantic, actively religious Jews, Catholics, Orthodox, Protestants have expressed much less hedonism and self-centered or self-oriented values in terms of their own kind of driving ethos. Now we have massive amounts of data on the generosity of time and money. Who gives of themselves to others, of their money and of their time as volunteers? Well, we can ask from studies done on behalf of independent sector, which studies charitable giving and volunteerism here in the United States, who's giving money away? And one Gallup survey done nationally for them found that weekly religious attenders gave away several times as much as non-attenders. That's also true in the United Kingdom. People who say religion is very important have been found to give away 3 times as much money as those who say religion is not very important. Who's working, volunteering among the poor, the infirm, or the elderly? Going back to the Gallup Spiritual Commitment Index, we see markedly higher rates of volunteerism among those most actively religiously engaged or highly spiritually committed. Or in another survey, who's doing charitable and social service volunteering is a function of how important they say religion is. Do you see a pattern here? Again, these aren't little differences. These are dramatic. These are huge differences in rates of volunteerism. But people have wondered, is this volunteerism just focused on the faith community? Is it really kind of in-group volunteerism as opposed to out-group volunteerism? So one recent Gallup-conducted study of 1,700 Americans ascertained how many were doing community volunteering that wasn't related to their church, and found that even here, weekly attenders were somewhat more likely to be volunteering of their time. Robert Putnam, in this new book that's coming out on American Grace, will be telling us that religious Americans are something like 3 times more likely to be involved in their community, in voluntary associations and attending public meetings and donating time and so forth into their community. He says that their studies find that actively religious people are also, in some sense, nicer, more likely to give money to a panhandler, to tolerate line violations of various kinds of measures. And he thinks the effect is causal because non-attenders become more likely to do these things after beginning to be religiously engaged. And he thinks it's not so much the religious belief system as it is the faith social support community system that is helping engender these pro-social behaviors, as we would call them. We also have data from 117,000 people surveyed across 53 countries in what's called the World Value Survey. And the researchers concluded that people who attend church twice a week are more than 5 times more likely to volunteer than people who never visit a church in terms of giving of their own time to others. Now here are data from the most massive survey of the human population that I've ever encountered, made available to me by a colleague social psychologist who's gone to work for the Gallup organization. I don't understand the economics of how they conduct these surveys, but they're surveying some 2,000 people a year now in 140 countries. So these data I'm about to show you represent about 300,000 people from the planet Earth gathered in just the last 3 years. Have you done any of the following in the last month? Have you donated to charity? Well, this is the percent of those who are less religious and who are more religious. And how are those terms defined? Highly religious are those who, number one, say religion is important in their daily lives, and number two, attended a service in the last week. The less religious is everybody else. Okay, let's ask a different question. Oh, by the way, you might wonder, looking at this, is this just because actively religious people have more money, and so they give away more money? The Gallup researchers said, actually, the opposite is the case. Highly religious people have less income than do less religious people. And thus, the data presented here offer compelling evidence of the role of religious dedication in helping to encourage supportive community-oriented behaviors, conclude the Gallup researchers. They also asked, who's volunteered time to an organization in the last month? Here's for your less religious in each of these four major areas of the planet Earth. And again, you can see that's about a 50% higher rate among those who meet the Gallup criterion for highly religious. How about helping a stranger or someone you didn't know who needed help? That's the less and the more religious from across the planet Earth. Averaging across all religions, all places on the planet Earth. Huge differences we're aggregating across, but still some interesting differences, don't you think? Additionally, we now have a new set of studies of what's called priming. These are experiments that in the laboratory subtly activate various cognitions without your necessarily knowing that these ideas are being seeded in your mind because of the subtle procedures that are used. And thus, for example, in one University of British Columbia experiment, which has been twice replicated, participants unscrambled sentences, which for some of them included some religion-related words, such as spirit, divine, God, and so forth. Later, when given a chance to decide how many dollar coins to keep and how many to give to an unseen stranger, those who earlier been primed with these God concepts were doubly generous in what they gave away as those who'd not been religiously primed. Another recent study was done in Germany. It's a very clever study of religion and trust. And what it did is gave the participants points which could be converted to euros. So let's just think of them as dollars, if you will. So you're given a supply of dollars, and for every one of those you give to another person whom you don't see but who's the trustee, that number will be tripled. So if you give 1 euro to the trustee gets 3 and then can decide whether to give any of those back to you, and if so, how many. Well, you're told certain things about this trustee you're going to give those points to, which will be converted to euros. One of which is disclosed is the trustee's religiosity. And it turned out that among these German participants, if you knew the trustee was highly religious, you were more likely to trust them with more money. And indeed, they bore that trust well because they were more likely to give you money back out of what you'd given to them. Well, Even Voltaire recognized this, as do many of today's skeptics, when he said, though I'm a thoroughgoing skeptic non-believer myself, I want my attorney, my tailor, my servants, even my wife to believe in God. Then I should be robbed and cuckolded less often. I don't believe, but I like believers around me for my own sake. So far, it looks like, in answer to the question, is religion toxic, dangerous, one of the world's great evils? Well, actually, religious engagement predicts rather strongly, in fact, happiness, health, and altruism of both time and money. So for people of faith, that's the good news. But I have some bad news for people of faith, or good news if you're a skeptic. And that is that there's a troubling reality out there that has been recognized by the new atheists, including people such as sociologist Phil Zuckerman, who's written recently of the virtues of godlessness. The least religious nations are the healthiest and most successful. And I want to show you some data that I've harvested that confirms what the new atheists and Zuckerman are saying. Secular, irreligious nations and states are really great places to live. If you were to be uprooted tonight and you were to be dropped into another state or another nation on the planet Earth without knowing what it would be, and you wanted a good life there, you should hope that it would be a secular, irreligious place. Let me show you the data that lead me to conclude that people in religious countries and states are actually less satisfied with their lives, despite the data I've shown you so far. People in religious states, as I'm going to show you, divorce more, smoke more, commit more crime. Whoa, what's going on here? Let's look at the data. First, from the Gallup World Survey, I've recently harvested some data with the help of a student assistant from 152 countries. And on the x-axis, you can see we'll have the percentage of people saying religion is important in each of these 152 countries. On the vertical axis, we have people's self-rated quality of life from zero, the life I'm living today is the worst possible life I can imagine, to 10, the best possible life. And here we go, folks, 152 countries. And as you can see, we've got a negative 0.52 correlation between the religiosity of the people of a country and the quality of life they experience in that country. And by the way, the range is from Denmark up at the top, the happiest place on earth, also secular Denmark, 20% say religion is important. And the unhappiest place is the West African nation of Togo in this survey, which is a highly religious country. If we ask a different question, how many attended religious services in the past 7 days, we find approximately similar, minus 0.43 correlation. Okay? The skeptics, if you will, are right. The highly religious places are not flourishing places in terms of human well-being. And let's look at data. Here I'm going to show you, however, data from a couple individual countries. There's a really curious phenomenon here that just has me absolutely fascinated. And if any of you can help me explain this, please do so. Let's look at data from Uganda and Ethiopia, for example. Okay, relatively highly religious countries where people aren't experiencing high quality of life. But now let's ask how you felt about your life yesterday. Did you enjoy your life a lot of the time in your day yesterday, Gallup asked. Here's data from Uganda showing a much higher rate of enjoyment among those for whom religion is important in their daily life than among those for whom religion is not important in their daily life. Here's data from Ethiopia, where we get exactly the same relationship. Now I'm going to show you a whole string of findings where you're going to see exactly the same thing. Secular places and religious individuals are doing the best in many different ways. Okay, let's see some more. By the way, my colleague Ed Diener, who's probably the world's leading happiness researcher, tells me that he's noticed the same thing. Across nations, there's a negative correlation between national religiosity and life satisfaction. If you control for income, which is lower in highly religious countries, the correlation disappears. If you do the correlation across individuals within any country, religious people have higher life satisfaction in almost every nation on earth. So it's, again, it's kind of an ironic finding. Now let's look at some state-by-state data. First, I harvested data for the divorce rate in the states of the West Coast and the states of the South. Now, you'll first of all see that on the x-axis, we have percentage of religious adherence. So the southern states all have more higher rates of religious engagement than do the West Coast states of Washington, Oregon, California, and Hawaii. They also have somewhat higher divorce rates if you average across this. So count one here for the new atheists. Aha! Religion is conducive to divorce. But let's look at it across individuals. Again, we have 52,000 randomly sampled Americans from the National Opinion Research Surveys, and they show us that the percent of married adults is higher among those who are religiously engaged as opposed to not engaged. And in fact, the percentage divorced is about one half in the United States among those highly often religiously engaged rather than never religiously engaged. So, irreligious West Coast states have lower divorce rates, and so do highly religious individuals. Okay, let's do it with another thing. How about smoking? Again, we see data for the West Coast states, and we see data for the southern states. Once again, of course, the southern states all have higher rates of religious adherence. Notice they also all have a higher smoking rate than do the healthier West Coast states. So anyway, this is the data across states. Now let's look at the data across individuals. For we see that people who attend religious services weekly or more are about one-fourth as likely to be active to be smokers as those who never attend religious services in the United States. Over the last 30 years, this is. So again, a very different picture for individuals than what we get for group entities. How about crime rates? Again, all the southern states. Yeah, all the southern states have higher crime rates than do all the West Coast states. So if you want to be safe, live in relatively secular Spokane, if you will, eastern Washington, as compared to highly religious Alabama or Mississippi, Louisiana there in the upper right. But if we ask who's been arrested in the United States as a function of religious engagement, we see, again, this dramatic difference with those actively religiously engaged having one-third the arrest rate of those never religiously engaged. I'm fine with this, though. Okay, I'll just give you that. Thanks. So, again, we see exactly the same pattern. And we're going to, by the way, here's just presenting the data in a different format. Do you smoke? Have you been punched or beaten? Have you been arrested? Here's the rate among those who never attend church, and here's been the rate over the last 30 years among those who attend weekly or more. And finally, let's take a look at teen pregnancy. This has been in the news recently because of dramatic tendency of people in the southern states, teens in the southern states, they have higher rates of teen pregnancy. The religious South, would you believe, has a dramatically higher teen pregnancy than the irreligious West Coast. I mean, take that Focus in the Family and smoke that one, if you will. I mean, it's a sort of that. But let's look at the data in a different way. Oh, by the way, this is also recently Kansas State University came out with some portrayals of what are the saintly and what are the devilish places in the United States. And as you can see, the highly religious South has dramatically higher rates of sexually transmitted disease per capita. So there's teen pregnancy, there's sexually transmitted disease in the highly religious southern states. Okay, now let's look across individuals. First, across adult individuals, people who say premarital sex is always wrong are most likely to be actively religious. People who say
religion, who are not actively religious at all, mostly don't think premarital sex is always wrong. But those are adults. What about teens in particular? Well, I've harvested data from the National Survey of Youth and Religion, from the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, and from a new meta-analysis that is a statistical digest of 87 studies looking at adolescent religiosity and sexuality. And here's what I learned. First, religiously engaged teens favor, at least give lip service to, sexual restraint. Of those who are religiously engaged weekly or more, they're dramatically more likely to support waiting till they're married. And in another one of these surveys, they report practicing sexual restraint. In the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescents, the percent who said they were not virgins was lower among those who attend religious services weekly rather than never at age 15. And then we also see that same relationship at age 18. And if we shift over to that other study, the National Survey of Youth and Religion, we find that the percent who have not had sex and are in no hurry to is dramatically higher among those who are actively religiously engaged as teens than those who are not religiously engaged. Okay? So sexual attitudes and sexual reported sexual behaviors are different in ways that wouldn't be conducive to teen pregnancy among actively religious teens. But are they not less likely to use birth control because they're less likely to plan for it? Well, here's data showing us the percentage of teens who use birth control at the time of their first sexual encounter and the most recent sexual encounter as a function of their religious engagement. And this is for those, this is first sex, and this is most recent sexual encounter. And as you can see, there's basically no relationship between religious engagement and use of birth control by those teens who are having sex or have had sex. So let's put all this together. We've seen that highly religious states have dramatically higher teen pregnancy rates. We've seen that highly religious individual teens are more supportive of true love waiting, more likely to, in fact, be virgins or be delaying first sex, and are not more or less likely to have to use birth control. And the composite of these findings predicts and explains why religiously active teens are, contrary to many anecdotes and much popular mythology, slightly less often pregnant than than their less religious counterparts. By the way, this interesting, I think, fascinating mix of findings showing us a really negative portrayal of religion when we examine it at the aggregate level, mindful that when you're comparing Alabama to Washington, you're comparing not just a more religious to a less religious place. You're comparing different demographic groups and education, ethnic composition, income, and so forth. All those things are mixed in as part of the comparison package. The new Cambridge Dictionary of Psychology defines as the ecological fallacy, the inference that what's true of a group, when you try to draw truth from group comparisons, is also true of a particular individual. I would suggest to you that the data that matter most are the data associated with individuals, because they're the ones having the religious experience and expressing its influence. By the way, we do have, a little bit mysteriously to me, some new data that was sent me in an unpublished form for comment by a European researcher, data from 90,000 Europeans that compares them by very small regions within countries, such as the United Kingdom, France, the Netherlands, and so forth. And they find that people are more satisfied with their lives in more religious regions. Like in the United Kingdom, that would probably be the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, which is a highly religious area, as opposed to the south of England. This spillover holds both for those who are religious and those who are not. In other words, you've got a pretty good life if you're in a highly religious, discrete region there, regardless of whether you participate in the religion. Which they call a spillover effect. Okay, how I assimilate that finding into the rest of these, I'm not sure yet. Well, this brings me to my conclusion, which is to restate what I said earlier, that religion comes in varied forms, And it surely had, across history, both perverse and beneficial associations. Second, nevertheless, it seems true that individuals' religious engagement is predictive of individual happiness, health, altruism, civility, and mature sexuality, or at least the delay of premature sexuality. And thus, evolutionary biologist David Sloan Wilson could conclude that Dawkins' diatribe against religion, however well-intentioned, it's one atheist talking to another, is deeply misinformed. And we have now people who are recognizing this from across these data that I've presented to you, from across the ideological spectrum. Thus, I did a book blurb for a new book that's just out entitled An Atheist Defends Religion by somebody who says, I don't believe in God. I don't find it credible. But I am totally persuaded by the evidence that religion is a positive force in human life, on balance, even though it's sometimes a negative, destructive force. And I would suggest to you that the Christian idea that all people are God's children whom the Creator admonishes us to love is a great motivator of human flourishing. It certainly gives a mandate for selfless compassion as we value all human lives equally. And it's certainly a contrast to the materialism that says, in the words of Richard Dawkins, that the universe has no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Nothing matters, ultimately. I would suggest to you that as you sometimes observe the culture war that's been going on in the United States between the religious right and the scientific left, that there might be a third alternative between those two, which is a spirituality of humility that is rooted in a still-developing biblical wisdom and a faith tradition that crosses centuries, that sees itself in a very open way as ever-reforming, acknowledging that it might be wrong, welcoming new insights from science and wherever else they might come, and that at its best helps make sense of the universe, gives meaning to life, opens us to the transcendent, connects us in supportive communities with one another, mandates morality and selflessness, and in the face of adversity and death, offers hope. And so the final paragraph of this little book of mine reads like this. Surely, in some ways, I'm wrong. You're wrong. We're all wrong. We glimpse ultimate reality as in a dim mirror, constrained by our cognitive limits. Perhaps then we can draw wisdom from both skepticism and spirituality by anchoring our lives in a rationality and humility that restrains spirituality with critical analysis, and in a spirituality that nurtures purpose, love, joy, and hope. Well, that's my response to the new atheists. As part of my conversation with them. And if you want to explore some essays related to this or to communicate with me afterwards, you'd be welcome to do so through my website, which is just myname.org.